But it is interesting, isn't it, how we decide to define ourselves, describe ourselves, understand ourselves. And what we want to do this morning is begin to think about how would we define ourselves in terms of how the Bible describes us. And of course, there's two parts to that, and one we won't go into today, which is you are uniquely made. God has given you a unique set of gifts and talents to use to worship him and to serve him, and service out of our loving response to his grace. But there's also a general sort of category of we're all bound together as human beings. And what we're going to look at a little bit this morning is what it means to be made in God's image, and mainly what the creation story tells us about what it means to be fully human. Although we will also point forward to other parts of the Bible story. And that's why I sort of wanted to just begin. We will focus this morning mainly on the creation story and what that tells us about what it means to be human. But the creation story is only the beginning of the big story that God gives us in the Bible. And there are several acts to that, aren't there? There are several stages. One way you can split up God's big story of history is into creation, the fall, redemption, and restoration. So that sort of explains the big pan of history that sort of God is revealing in the Bible. So we start with creation, then we see how things went very wrong for not just humans, but the whole of creation. Then we see redemption in Jesus Christ, how he heralds the kingdom of God to come, and how he is beginning the restoration project with his incarnation and then death and resurrection, which points forward to eternity and the restoration of all things in a new heaven and a new earth. Just as a sidebar, you know, often in our churches, don't we? We talk about we long to go to heaven. Well, the reality is heaven is a waiting room. Because it's, you know, you don't, when you're going on holiday, think, even if I'm in the business class lounge, this is it. This is my holiday. You long for the ultimate destination. So restoration is in a renewed, redeemed heaven and earth. As Jen said, what we're going to do this morning is get you to sort of be talking and grappling with some of the things that we want to learn together. And we're going to do that not just this morning, but through the week, with a series of case studies that sort of not real examples, but sort of examples that hopefully speak to you in real life, and think about how we can begin to use the Bible and some tools in the Bible and some of its teaching as a framework for us to better understand and then deal with some of the issues that come up with us in life, but particularly with you as leaders. The case study that we're going to look at this morning, I suspect that this case study may resonate very personally with you, either because you've been through a season of life like this, but I suspect even if you haven't, you will have got some close friends or colleagues that have gone through something like this. And the case study is this, that you've got a friend, and on the surface, your friend's life looks great. Things are going well. They may be married and got a lovely family, nice house, sort of perfectly sort of, you know, the children behave, do well in exams, you know, they're on the sports team. But even in work, things seem to be going well. They're part of maybe a successful ministry or organization. And things on the surface look good for this person. There's no reason why this person shouldn't think, life is good, I'm satisfied with how things are going. Yeah, things could be better, but generally, things are good. But because you're a good friend, you know that that's a surface impression. And that in reality, when you scratch underneath the surface of this person's life, you realize that work isn't as nice and smooth and as successful as it seems on the surface. That it really is toil and difficulty and lots of challenges. And some of those challenges are quite a burden to carry. So there are frustrations in work. Sometimes that may be because of colleagues who aren't performing very well, or frustrations because maybe that you sort of don't think are problems, but really are. Frustrations of, there are so many opportunities to do good. Which do I take? the frustration of thinking, I've got to leave some really good things I want to do to one side because I have to do these other things. And as I say, it's not just work that has a ripple effect. So the challenges and burdens that your friend is carrying at work, the frustrations that they have, are having a ripple effect into their personal life. They may be showing signs of being workaholics, that the only way to get through the challenges of work is to work all hours to try to get that to-do list finished and completed on time. But that then has a knock-on effect on family life. There are strains in their family life, so what seems a perfect marriage is a bit creaky. Maybe that's because they're not spending much time, maybe because the frustrations of work are being brought home as well. So your friend looks as if they've got a good life, but you know that life is not just a series of what looks good. You also know that life is not just a series of experiences that make you happy. And you know that your friend really is lacking in joy. So the challenge is, what do you do as a friend? And this is a stepping stone that gets us from just reacting to the case study to moving towards a biblical framework to think about what a good life for your friend looks like, and by implication, what a good life for you looks like, and how you can use the whole of the Bible story to work that out, and then by implication, think about what part you can play in empowering your friend and facilitating them to have a good life. So what we're going to do is read the first three chapters of Genesis, a good chunk of reading the Bible for you this morning. In English, that's taken me quietly reading in my head about 4 or 5 minutes in total. So I suspect there were maybe 4 or 5 minutes of silence in the group while you're reading it, maybe in your own language. And then what I want you to do in groups is think about those first three chapters and what do we learn? What I want you to do is sort of read those chapters, then discuss in your group, what do you think we learn about human beings? What do we learn about ourselves in those first three chapters? And then actually, what do we learn about God in those first three chapters? And in the sort of reflecting on what do we learn about ourselves as humans, maybe think about what does God tell us our job description is? What do we learn in those first three chapters about when do we flourish as human beings? When do we sort of really fulfill our potential? And what can we expect experience in this world to be like? Well, what we're going to do, and the reason for I gave you, I'll just repeat, the reason why I wanted you to read the beginning of Genesis was we're not going to exclusively stay in the creation part of the story today, but we are going to spend most of our time in that to understand ourselves as humans, what we are called to do, what we're designed to do, and under what conditions do we flourish. And then we'll more briefly go on to sort of understand, well, what's happened that has taken us away from that, and where are we heading? So creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. And what we're going to then do is apply that to your friend's life, to think about how our understanding of that can actually unlock sort of the picture of what a good life can look like under God's rule and under his direction. And if we then evaluate that against what our experience is, how do we sort of maybe begin to think about tactics that bridge some of that gap? Understanding that restoration is in the future. So we'll only ever be able to point to full restoration, but we can begin to point and work towards it. So let me sort of just introduce it. And again, the point here, I think, for me is to just bring my very personal experience, is that some of the most useful things that I've sort of grappled with to try to put my own life into context and my own troubles and challenges is not to diminish them, but when we understand how we are not living in a pre-Copernican world where we think we are the earth and everything revolves around us. but actually we are called into God's story, aren't we? So there are wonderful stories that we all have, individual stories that God is weaving in our lives. But that is all a strand in this great big tapestry that God has for history. So we are called as players into his story. Now, the implication of that also is that we're not the audience. So we're not bystanders in this, which is why we're going to use this framework to apply to case studies and to the case study that we share this morning. We're not bystanders looking from afar thinking, theoretically, I know what's good for that person, but I'm going to stay out of it. No, we're called into God's story to experience it, be part of it. And the amazing thing is to sort of, he gives us a role in his story. So we're not the audience, but we're sort of players in that story. So it starts with creation, doesn't it? So we start with creation. And that's what you've been looking mainly at in the first two chapters of Genesis. And again, the list I'm going to go through is not a prioritized list. They're all of equal value, these points. But I want to start off by saying that we are created as image bearers. And one thing that that means is that we are stewards over God's creation. What that means is that we have authority and responsibility over creation to care for it and to develop it. Not to exploit it, but to cultivate it, to create, to cultivate, to develop. Now, why is that that important? Well, first of all, it means that we do carry responsibility. So our perfect lives is not sitting on a beach somewhere devoid of responsibility. That is actually not our calling. That is not our ideal life, if we are really sort of speaking to how we were made and how we were designed by God. We are designed to carry responsibility. We are designed to take what God gives us authority over and to make something of it, to develop it. It's the classic sort of image, isn't it? Sort of God does not call us to be museum curators. He does not call us to be park rangers, just keep everything as it is. No, he calls us to be gardeners, to develop and cultivate. So when we think about ourselves and we think about our friends, the ideal life is not sitting on a beach, is not just, oh, let's not make waves, let's just keep everything as it is. No, we're called to develop. That's our responsibility. Secondly, we're designed for relationship. Do you notice that in the creation narrative, we don't actually get the specific of God first making the male of a species and then the female, or the female and then the male. He just makes the different kinds of animals and plants until it comes to us as humans, where he specifically says that it's not good for the man to be alone, which is why he makes Eve. Now, that reflects, doesn't it, that God is relationship and community. So we believe in one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So there's a unity, but a community in the Godhead. And made in his image mean that we crave for relationship. I was chatting yesterday about being an introvert. We made that exercise at the beginning, and some of us were way over here, all introverted. Some of you are way over there, you crazy, weird people that you are, sort of extroverts. But being introvert doesn't necessarily mean that you always like being alone. It just means that you don't get your energy from a room full of people and like interacting with loads of people. So I'm a strong introvert, but there's nothing better than actually having a really deep, meaningful conversation with a close friend. And so we crave for relationship, don't we? I was telling, I can't remember if it was Jen or not, I was sort of, this shows you how romantic I am, when I sort of decided to propose to my wife. After she said yes, I said, I knew that we had to get married because you're the only person I can stand for more than 1 week at a time. So that was meant to be romantic. That actually I do find people draining. I love you all, but after a couple of hours, I need a break. I paid the single room supplement to be on my own. But if I was just to stay in my room every day of this conference, I would be impoverished. So whether you're an extrovert, there are times you need to be sort of come away and reflect and sort of have that reflective time. And as an introvert, you are designed to be in relationship with others. That has implications, doesn't it, on how we lead our lives, how we structure our lives. So we know ourselves, whether we're extrovert or introvert, but equally, we're not purely one or the other. Power. There's a great book by an author called Andy Crouch that many of you may know called Playing God, which massively influenced how I thought about power and the dynamics of power. And we see that at work in the creation story. I'm going to use an example that may be old for most of you in your room, but for Gen Xer like me, it was very meaningful. Star Trek. Every generation gets its new Star Trek sort of generation of characters and people playing the roles. And for my generation and Andy Crouch's generation, it was Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek The Next Generation. And his catchphrase was, number one, make it so. And Andy Crouch says, isn't it wonderful that we have a God that isn't like Jean-Luc Picard and says, make it so? Because what we see in Genesis 1 is a God that said, let there be. Now, that may not seem very significant, but think of the implications. If you've got a God who says, make it so, that's a very prescriptive, very definitive, very restrictive command. You've got a very clear idea, I want this to happen in this way at this point in time. But we have a God that basically uses his power to say, let there be, and into that space, creation is filled. Teams is diverse. So we see the source of all power, the creator God of everything, the ultimate source of all power, doesn't cling on to power, he gives it away. He says, I am the God that is the ultimate source of power, but what I'm going to do is give it away to my creation. I'm going to give it away so that my creation can take that power and run with it and do something amazing, brilliant, fantastic, awe-inspiring with the power that I give them. And we as image bearers are given power as well as responsibility. How are we going to use it? Are we going to use it in the fallen world as the world would like us to seem that all power is used, as in we need power, we want power, I'm going to grab it. It's a zero-sum gain. If you've got power and I've got less of it, my objective in life is to get the power from you so I can then impose my will and influence on you. It's a zero-sum gain. That's not the creation story of power. The creation story of power is that it's a multiplier effect. It's not a zero-sum gain equation. So we are called to not just be holding power, but to give it away. And how does God give it away? He gives it away in ways that empower the people he gives it to. We see that in examples of the godly use of power throughout the Bible, and ultimately in Jesus, in how he gives his power away so that others can flourish and live. How does that impact how we live our lives and how we help other people live our lives? Are we those who say, I'm going to give you some of my power so that you can thrive? What is it that I can do to empower you? And sometimes that will be sacrificial and there will be the cost, but sometimes it will be big and sacrificial and meaningful. Sometimes it will be unnoticeable. So power. Fourth, it was mentioned very early on, we are created to work. That's amazing, isn't it? Because so often the world will say, oh, work is a curse. And they are truer than they know they are. It is a work has been cursed, but work isn't a curse. And I don't know if you've ever been sort of recognized this, but in Genesis 1 and 2, there are actually two words for work that are being used that are translated as work in those two chapters. One word is malacha, and the other one is avodah. Now, I've got to take this on trust. I am not a Hebrew expert, but the people that have told me this, I trust implicitly. Malacha is the sort of the artisanal work, the craftsman's work. the stuff that was covered by Malacca type work was the work that was prohibited on the Sabbath. So there's a long list of things that sort of craftspeople do that you're not allowed to do in sort of Judaic law, sort of on a Sabbath. But Malacca is that sort of craftsman. We're designed to be craftsmen, to sort of take a pride in our work, to work excellently. And there's a fulfillment in that. We are designed to work, and when we use our skills and our gifts, there's a fulfillment in that. There must be days when you do a job or finish a project and you say, yeah, I feel good about that. That's made me feel really good. That's a glimpse of what work was designed to be. And then there's avodah as work that was used in chapter 2. And avodah is a word that's translated in lots of different ways in the Old Testament. And sometimes it's translated as slavery or enslavement. Sometimes it's service. And sometimes it's worship. So again, isn't it amazing that when we read about work before the fall, it is in some way an act of service and an act of worship to God? So again, how are we encouraging our teams, our colleagues, our friends to not see work as a curse? Yes, that work is cursed, but before the fall, it was an act of where we could find joy and fulfillment, an act of worship to God. So how do we regain a good perspective and process of thinking about work? And then finally, rest. It was mentioned that Adam and Eve weren't arrested, but they did rest. And that is an important part of the sustainable rhythm of life, of what it means to be human. You see, the world will say that the objective of our lives is to spend the first bit of our lives learning and accumulating knowledge and skills and equipping ourselves to then sprint flat out for the next 40 years. And then hopefully in that sprinting, you've gained enough resources where you can collapse over the line at the end of the day. A friend of mine who does a lot of work on the theology of work said that in the West, the ultimate objective of every working person is that they get to the age of 70 and can do this. And the point is that that playing golf is reflecting that you've got your physical health and you've got money to be able to play the round of golf and you've got leisure time. But that's not the biblical pattern, is it? Actually, the biblical pattern is that, yes, we work excellently and with industry, but there's also a day of rest. And later in the Old Testament, that's expanded, isn't it? In a national level and thinking about sort of years of Jubilee, etc. There's a godly and sustainable rhythm to life, which includes rest. Rest is radical, friends, in our lives. And the part of being human that says that we acknowledge rest and we take rest will be a radical message to the world around you. Rest is one of the ultimate marks that you trust God. When you don't take your Sabbath rest, and I'm not being legalistic about this, I do not sort of say, right, I'm not doing any work on Sundays. The rhythm and seasons of life mean that there are busy patterns. You sort of take bits of time to rest, etc. But the point of rest, partly, is to say that my to-do list, do you know what? I have a responsibility to carry out those tasks, but ultimately things do not depend on me. It may feel to you on some days as if the world will stop turning if you stop working, but trust me, the sun will rise tomorrow, with or without your efforts today. So trust the Lord is sovereign and that his will for a good pattern in your life is good. So rest, that is one of the most profound, challenging, transformative lessons you can adopt personally and get your friends and colleagues to adopt. And particularly if you're involved in Christian ministry, because after all, you're working for the Lord. How can you possibly rest? This is the Lord's work. Well, the Lord actually wants you to have a sustainable rhythm in life. The downside of this, let me tell you, is The Bible doesn't talk about retirement. Because if you're working sustainably, there may be a time when you get stopped being paid for work, but there's no such thing as retirement. Think of all the amazing Bible characters who really only got started in their sort of 60s, 70s, 80s. So there's no such thing as retirement if we're willing to implement a sustainable pattern in life. We'll touch upon the fall, redemption and restoration. Fall, obviously, I'll very, very briefly, 2 minutes on each one of those. The fall explains why life is so difficult and so rubbish. We need to remember that the fall is not just some personal individual sin. It has infected every molecule of creation. And the creation longs, that's why it yearns for restoration and redemption, because the fall infected everything, and therefore every part of life, from our thinking to our doing to our relationships, is a mark of the fall. That will cause frustration, that will mean that we have sinful desires, that we have to sort of think about spiritual disciplines to redress, and it will mean that relationships are broken. There's an author called Stephen Garber from the US who says one of the chief challenges of Christians is when you quite realize how broken the world is, how do you love an unlovable world? And that's because of redemption, because Jesus. Again, I'm not going to go through the bullet points there, but there are implications of Jesus saying, I'm announcing the kingdom has come. We've started, guys. It's the end. It's the beginning of the end. And we look at Jesus as a role model for what we are working towards, how we can deal with the brokenness of the world in a God-like, Christ-like way. And the key element there is, how do you implement speaking truth and love to those around you? Where it's sometimes all about truth and we lack love and grace. Or sometimes we're so much about grace and love that we forget to talk truth to our friends because it's difficult. Grace is the big sort of takeaway from redemption. And then restoration, that we are pointing to how things will be one day. We have hope, somebody said earlier. And of course, the things that we do now will be redeemed. There's a Japanese art that I don't know if you're aware of. Now, this may not be the pronunciation, but is it kintsugi? Which is sort of mending broken pottery with gold. One theologian said that when he was asked sort of, what was Jesus' mission? He said, well, it was to mend the brokenness of this world. And we, being image bearers, living a life of responding to God's love and Jesus' grace, well, we are Christ-like in trying to mend brokenness wherever we see it. And we don't know how God will take that and it will be reflected in the New Jerusalem. But we know that the wealth of the nations will be taken into the New Jerusalem. We know from Isaiah, the ships of Tarshish, which were sinful, were redeemed to be sort of part of the God's new creation. So who knows what you do now, how it will be reflected in eternity.